Welcome back to the deep dive. Today, we've got a really fascinating stack of source material here. It's basically a foundational clinical reference.
The ultimate nursing cheat sheet, you could say.
Exactly. Yeah. And our mission really is to cut right to the chase. We're pulling out the absolute bedrock stuff.
The critical numbers,
yeah.
Core definitions, those immediate interventions that you just, well, you have to know in high stakes situations.
Right. We're not going for sheer volume here.
No. Definitely not. It's all about high leverage knowledge. These are the facts that, I mean, if you understand them and apply them right, they act as immediate red flags.
And they guide that immediate treatment. Think of this as your shortcut, maybe, to understanding clinical urgency.
Precisely.
Okay, so we've kind of broken this down into three main areas for this deep dive. First, the physical stuff.
The foundation.
Yeah, the assessment. That systematic six-part approach, covering vitals, consciousness, yeah. All that. And then we'll get into the internal engine, you could call it, looking at those complex breathing patterns and the language of arterial blood gases, ABGs.
The body's chemistry.
Exactly. And finally, we'll hit that critical knowledge where timing is just everything. Insulin action profiles and the essential antidote checklist.
Sounds good. Let's start where any good assessment really begins, right? The methodical head to toe.
Right.
What's really key here, I think, is the discipline it takes to cover those six major systems quickly, but also accurately.
It's not just ticking boxes, is it?
Not at all. You're building a story, a comprehensive picture of the patient, pretty much in real time.
Okay, let's unpack this systematic approach then. We start at the top. Neuro.
Neurological.
And this isn't just asking, you know, are you awake? It's deeper. Assessing mental status, level of consciousness.
And those crucial signs like coralae.
Coralae, right. Maybe break that down quickly.
Sure. Pupils equal, yeah. Round. Reactive to light and accommodation, plus checking their full range of motion.
So you're really assessing how the brain's talking to the rest of the body.
Exactly. And from there, you move right into the circulatory system. Cardio.
Heart rate, blood pressure.
Yeah. Quality of peripheral pulses, capillary refill, which is such a quick check for perfusion.
And skin signs too, right? Color, Kirger.
All part of that perfusion assessment. You got it.
Okay. After cardio, we're looking at input and output systems. So respiratory.
Yeah. Rate pattern, O2 saturation, quality of breath sounds, the works.
And then renal function. Assessing urine output, consistency, bladder status.
And you have to pair that immediately with a GI assessment. Listening for bowel sounds, palpating the abdomen, any tenderness or distension.
Noting elimination frequency, too.
Mm-hmm. And finally, the body's biggest organ. Skin.
Turgor. Moisture, temperature.
And crucially, any signs of breakdown. Bruising, things that might flag pressure injuries or even coagulation issues.
So that six-part system, neuro, cardio, resp, GI, renal, skin, that's the full snapshot.
It gives you the complete picture, yeah.
And underpinning all of that, I guess, are the vital signs. Simple, but so powerful.
The baseline.
Before we can really interpret anything, we need to know what's actually normal. So give us those tight baseline ranges we need locked in.
Okay. Standard blood pressure, the gold standard number we aim for, is around 120 over 80.
Got it.
Heart rate needs to be between 60 and 100 beats per minute. Respirations, that's a really tight window, 12 to 18 breaths per minute.
12 to 18, okay.
O2 saturation should hold steady between 95% and 100%. And temperature, there's a little flex, but generally 97 to 99.1 degrees Fahrenheit.
So any sustained reading outside those windows tells you the body's under stress.
Absolutely. Something's up.
Okay. This is where it gets really interesting for me. Assessing consciousness subjectively. The Glasgow Coma Scale, GCS.
Ah, the GCS. It's like an international language for neurological function, isn't it?
It really is.
And it's so powerful because it takes something subjective, like consciousness level, and slaps an objective number on it.
Right. So let's break it down. Eye-opening.
Okay, top score is 4. Eyes open spontaneously. Then 3 is opening only to speech. 2 is only to pain.
And 1?
1 is no response at all. Total unresponsiveness.
Okay. Then verbal response. This judges cognitive function, right?
Exactly. Perfect 5 means fully oriented. They know who they are, where they are, the date, you know.
But the scores going down are key.
Definitely.
Yeah.
4 is confused. 3, they're using inappropriate words. 2 is just incomprehensible sounds like moaning. And 1, again, no verbal response. You're grading the quality there.
And the last one, motor response, goes up to 6.
Yeah, 6 is obeying commands. That's the best you could hope for. But when neurological distress hits, those lower numbers are frankly, clinical nightmare.
Tell us about those. A score of 3.
Okay, a motor score of 3 is abnormal flexion, sometimes called decorticate posturing.
Decorticate, okay.
And that usually points to damage above the brainstem. Arms flexed in towards the core.
And if that motor score drops even lower to a 2.
That's critical. A score of 2 is abnormal extension or decerebrate posturing.
Decerebrate. Worse.
Generally indicates a much more severe injury. Mm. Often lower down in the brainstem, you see the arms and legs extending out rigidly. It's a really bad sign.
So seeing that posture is an immediate signal of, well, potentially catastrophic damage. Needs swift intervention.
Absolutely. Those specific postures are crucial insights you get from the GCS.
Wow. So the GCS really is much more than just a number. It's almost like a topographical map of potential injury.
That's a great way to put it. Exactly.
Okay, let's shift gears now. From the surface assessment, let's go deeper. Section 2. The language of respiration and internal chemistry.
Right.
We mentioned eupnea, that's normal breathing, but these specific named abnormal patterns, they tell a really deep diagnostic story.
They absolutely do. We can start simple. Tachypnea.
Increased rate. Fever, pain, maybe.
Could be.
Yeah.
And bradytypnea is the opposite, decreased rate. That's often a red flag for respiratory depression, meds, stroke, injury.
Okay, but the complex named patterns, let's break those down. Chain Stokes.
Chain Stokes breathing. It's rhythmic. The rate and depth increase, then decrease, and then apnea. The period of no breathing at all.
And what's that associated with?
Often things like congestive heart failure, CHF, kidney failure, or damage to the brain's respiratory centers. Could even be a terminal pattern sometimes.
Okay. Then there's Kussmaul breathing. I always think of that as the body desperately trying to compensate.
That's a perfect way to remember it. Kussmaul involves both tachypnea fast rate and hyperpnea increased depth.
So rapid, deep breathing.
Exactly. Classically seen when the body's trying to blow off CO2 to fix severe acid buildup, like in diabetic ketoacidosis.
Right. DKA.
Makes sense.
What about Byart's breathing and apneustic?
Okay, Byart's is different. It's clusters of rapid, almost gasping breaths, but with these short, unpredictable pauses in between.
Irregular.
Very irregular. Apneustic breathing, on the other hand, is characterized by a prolonged inspiration, like a deep breath held and followed by a short, kind of insufficient expiration.
Hmm. Recognizing those patterns really points you towards specific problems, doesn't it? Brain issues, systemic stuff.
Instantly.
And often, those problems show up most acutely in the arterial blood gases, the ABGs.
Ah, yes, the language of internal chemistry. And those normal ranges are notoriously tight.
It's amazing how stable the body tries to keep things, that pH range.
It's the tightest window we talk about, really, 7.35 to 7.45. I mean, you see a pH of 7.30, you know immediately you're dealing with some serious acidosis.
Just that tiny shift. Incredible. Russ. What about the other core component?
Okay, PaCO2, that's the respiratory part managed by the lungs. Normal is 35 to 45 millimeters of mercury.
35 to 45.
PaO2, the partial pressure of oxygen, should be 80 to 100. And HCO3 bicarbonate, that's the metabolic buffer from the kidneys.
The kidneys roll.
Right. That's 22 to 26 milliequivalents per liter. These values, they're like the acid, the whole acid-base balance pivots on.
What's really useful, I find, is connecting these ABG imbalances directly to the clinical events that cause them. Like, let's talk metabolic acidosis. What causes that?
Good way to frame it. Think of metabolic acidosis coming from, say, two main camps. Either things that produce too much acid the body can't easily get rid of.
Like DKA or kidney failure.
Exactly. Diabetic ketoacidosis, renal failure. Or the other camp is things that make you lose too much base too quickly, like severe diarrhea.
So you're either adding acid or losing base. Simple.
Pretty much sums it up. Yeah.
Okay. So metabolic alkalosis must be the reverse then, losing acid or holding on to too much base.
Precisely. Metabolic alkalosis is often driven by things that remove acid from the body. The classic example is continuous gastric suctioning.
Like with an NG tube?
Right, or chronic vomiting. It can also be caused by excessive diuretic use, which messes with electrolytes and leads to alkalosis.
Gotcha. And respiratory acidosis, that always comes down to breathing too slowly, right? Hypoventilation?
Always. You're trapping CO2. The lungs just aren't moving enough air.
What kind of things cause that?
Anything that slows down or obstructs breathing. Severe pneumonia, maybe neuromuscular paralysis, a bad COPD flare-up, blocking airflow, or even just over-sedation from opioids or anesthesia.
Which means respiratory alkalosis has to be the opposite. Hyperventilation? Breathing too fast?
Correct. Blowing off too much CO2.
Why would the body do that?
Usually happens when the body's under high demand or stress, like with a really high fever, or severe anemia, making you breathe deep and fast, even early stages of CHF, where the patient is just desperate for air.
Makes sense. Okay, before we jump to drugs, let's quickly tie up that output system we touched on earlier. Urinary definitions. Gotta know the difference here.
Oh yeah, Q terms are essential for talking about kidney status.
Anuria.
Total absence of urine.
Critical.
Highly critical. Oliguria is just a concerning decrease in output, usually less than, say, 400 milliliters in 24 hours.
And then diuresis.
Increased urine production.
Yeah.
And dysuria, painful urination. And hematuria, that's blood in the urine.
Right. Fast, clear definitions. They make all the difference in reporting changes quickly. Could agree more. All right, let's pivot. Section 3, timing and toxicity. Drug management. Insulin is a big one here. Timing isn't just important.
It's everything. It's the difference between stable blood sugar and potentially life-threatening hypoglycemia. It's a genuine speed race.
And you can't mix up the types.
Absolutely not. Take rapid-acting insulin, like Lispro. Incredibly fast onset. We're talking 15 minutes.
Wow, 15 minutes.
Yeah, and it peaks quickly, around 1 hour, which means the patient's food must be right there, ready to go.
Okay, compare that to short-acting insulin, regular R.
Short-acting or regular is a bit slower, steadier. Onset is more like 30 minutes, gives you a little more wiggle room.
Well, but peak?
Much wider peak time, around 2 to 5 hours. And that peak time tells you when the patient's at the highest risk for their sugar dropping too low.
Risk of hypoglycemia during that window. Got it. And then the long-acting ones, like Lantus, their profile is totally different.
Radically different application, yeah. The key thing with long-acting is sustained coverage. Onset is maybe 1 to 2 hours, but, and this is crucial, it has no defined peak time.
No peak. That's the big takeaway.
Exactly. That flat profile is what makes it great for steady basal coverage over 24 hours, helps prevent those overnight lows.
That non-peak feature is really its defining safety point. Okay, now the critical antidote checklist. When toxicity happens, the response needs to be specific, immediate.
No hesitation. The classic pairing everyone knows, or should know, opioid overdose needs naloxone.
Narcan reverses that respiratory depression instantly.
Right. What about for warfarin, the oral anticoagulant?
That's vitamin K, right? Helps the body make clotting factors again.
Correct. And for heparin, the other big anticoagulant often given IV.
Protamine sulfate.
Protamine sulfate, yep. And acetaminophen overdose, tragically common, devastating for the liver.
Acetylcysteine, that's the intervention.
Acetylcysteines. And finally, benzodiazepines, things like Valium or Ativan, which can cause severe CNS depression.
Reversed with Flumazenil.
Flumazenil. These five pairings, they are absolutely high-yield, life-saving knowledge.
Definitely. Okay, let's finish this section by looking at therapeutic drug levels. Medications where the line between helping and harming is razor thin.
That narrow therapeutic window.
Yeah. The famous ones that come to mind are lithium and digoxin. What are those tight windows? And what are the red flags if you go over?
Okay, digoxin, used for heart failure, arrhythmias. The window is just 0.5 to 2 nanograms per milliliter. Tiny range.
0.5 to 2 ngml. What happens if it goes higher?
If a patient's level creeps past, say, 2.5, they could start showing toxicity. Nausea, vomiting, and the classic one is visual changes, seeing halos around lights.
Wow. Okay. And lithium. For bipolar disorder, that range is notoriously tight.
It is the tightest one on our list, I think. 0.8 to 1.5 millimoles per liter.
0.8 to 1.5 millimole, even tighter.
Yeah. And toxicity symptoms start with things like severe tremors, confusion, and it can quickly spiral into seizures and coma if it's not caught right away. Constant blood level monitoring is essential.
Absolutely. We also had phenytoin on the list, the anti-seizure med. That's 10 to 20 milligrams per liter.
10 to 20 milligrams. Still needs watching. And the antiarrhythmics also demand precision.
Like amiodarone?
Amiodarone needs to stay between 0.5 and 2 milligrams per liter. And lidocaine, often used acutely for dangerous heart rhythms.
Ventricular arrhythmias.
Right. That's 1.5 to 5 milligrams per liter. These are drugs where you're often checking blood levels daily because a tiny dosing change can be the difference between stable rhythm and, well, severe crisis.
Okay, that was a really comprehensive deep dive into these clinical essentials. We covered a lot, from scoring consciousness with GCS, decoding those strange breathing patterns like Kussmaul and apneustic.
Right down to the counterintuitive causes of acid-base imbalances.
Yeah. And this knowledge, it's not just about passing an exam, is it? It's about anticipating when things might go wrong clinically.
Absolutely. Understanding the specific numbers and definitions lets you move beyond just saying, oh, the number is low.
Mm.
You can start interpreting the severity of the problem.
Seeing the whole picture.
Exactly. Knowing the clinical context behind these values is what makes the knowledge truly actionable.
Couldn't agree more. Okay, as we wrap up, here's a final thought for you, our listener, to maybe chew on. If continuous gastric suctioning leads to metabolic alkalosis, right? And something like DKA leads to metabolic acidosis. How does the body's incredibly intricate balancing act prioritize maintaining that super narrow pH range, 7.35 to 7.45?
Good question.
What instantaneous compensatory mechanisms must the lungs and kidneys kick into gear to pull the system back from the brink when these powerful forces are pushing it off balance? Think about that immediate response, especially from the respiratory side. Something to ponder.